Hi, everybody. It's Alonso. Thanks for joining us for LKTV. This is a show that's usually only available for our Patreon subscribers, but we're making it free for everybody as our holiday gift to you. A couple things to note about this episode. Usually, LKTV, like Linoleum Knife, is a clean podcast, but this episode has some swears in it, so if you were going to maybe listen to it in the car with your kids, maybe don't. Also, this was an interview conducted via Zoom, and as such, the audio is kind of terrible. So be ready for some very loud louds and some very quiet quiets. Our apologies. We don't know how to do this. Anyway, thanks for listening. Linoleum, patreon.com/linoleumknife.
TV. TV. TV.
LKTV.
A podcast of the television. And this is our holiday gift to you, as Phil Spector might have said. This is normally a show that is reserved for our Patreon subscribers, but it's the end of the year and we're taking some time off, but we're making all of our Patreon shows available on our main LK feed to let you know what you've been missing and to maybe entice you to become subscribers yourselves in the new year.
I feel like we are having a 48-hour recording session of Pop Rocket right now. because yesterday, we were recording this on December 9th. Yesterday, you and I were Zoom guests on Waiting to Exhale, which is their holiday break episode that they're doing. And so yesterday we sat down with Karen and Winter, and today we get Margaret Wappler.
No, but she's on our list. We're coming for you, Margaret. No, we're thrilled to have with us today the great, great Guy Branum, who's, you know, a list of credits as long as your arm. But let's never forget that he is the author of the extraordinary, funny, and moving memoir, My Life as a Goddess. And get the audiobook if you haven't already. It made me weep behind the wheel of the car. So good stuff there. Supervising producer on one of our very favorite shows, The Other Two. His magnum opus talk show, The Game Show, is currently available on HBO Max. And yes, you did see him in that one scene on Hacks. Welcome to LKTV, Guy Branum.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me. What did you guys talk to Karen and Winter about?
Hallmark Christmas movies.
Oh, that's lovely. Not something I had experienced before, but I recently worked on a movie with Luke McFarlane.
Yes.
Who stars in them left and right. And so now I've seen A Shoe Addict's Christmas. And I just watched Single All the Way. And I'm looking forward to hearing what you boys had to say on LKTV.
Yeah, I have been a fan of Mr. McFarlane's work for a while. Mistletoe Promise, my personal favorite. But we all have our own selections. Yeah, no, he is co-starring in Bros coming out in 2022, as are
yes.
you.
Yes.
Probably the film I'm most looking forward to. The queer rom-com where even the straight roles are played by LGBT actors.
They're going to try to get people to go to a movie theater for a comedy. Who knows if that can happen in the 2020s?
Well, you know, there's always Peacock. I don't know. So we've been wanting to get you on the show for a while, and we definitely wanted to have you on for this particular topic as part of our, you know, self-care during the pandemic. Dave and I recently launched into, for me, probably my fourth or fifth, but we had ourselves a rewatch of the 1970s classic, The Mary Tyler Moore Show, all seven seasons, all 168 question mark.
A lot of episodes.
Episodes, yeah. and we know that it's a fave of yours as well, so we wanted to really dig in with somebody who is not just somebody who's a fan of the show, but who toils in the world of TV and so has an even deeper appreciation for what those folks all managed to pull off over those seven seasons.
And this goes back to a very specific tweet exchange between y'all where Guy, you said that you really wanted to talk about Road to the Beautiful. And so that when you said that, I thought, oh yes, exactly. Because that episode and Mary Dates Lou are two episodes for me that are, in my head, they're inextricably linked for various reasons.
Well, I mean, I've never thought about it that way, but you're so smart to do it, because it's the in my opinion, the best made sitcom we've got, breaking its formula. Eat it. Like, Mindy Kaling has a line from Greg Daniels, which is, don't eat your seed corn. Like, do not don't let the characters grow so much that the game of the character changes. And both of those are like coming really close to breaking the show. But I mean, the amazing thing about the Mary Tyler Moore Show is she goes to a new apartment. You lose Rhoda and Phyllis. Like, there are so many changes that happen, but they are savvy enough to be able to give you Georgette and Sue Ann and like be able to engineer what this show is as it evolves. It's almost like, I think that Cheers was given several more years of life by Shelley Long leaving and Rebecca, whatever her name is, fat actress showing up, and Kirstie Alley. And I feel like the spinoffs of the Mary Tyler Moore Show managed to give it life, but also the invention there. But yeah, Road to the Beautiful is my favorite episode of episodic television that's ever been made.
Well, let's unpack what happens in that one. Rhoda, who the premise of the show has always been that she is the fat, dumpy neighbor, even though she's played by Valerie Harper, who, even when you put her in like sweatsuits, which they would do on the show, is still like a very attractive lady. But constantly with the fat jokes, I believe there's this show that gave us the world, the idea of like, I don't know why I'm eating this. I should just apply it directly to my hips, which became something of a mantra of the 70s and beyond for dieters. So we get to an episode in which she has been losing weight via Weight Watchers with Mary's coworker Murray, and in fact gets entered into a beauty pageant at the department store where she works at Hempel's. And, you know, cue 10,000 self-esteem jokes. And yet at the same time, she willingly participates in this pageant and takes it seriously, even though everybody around her sort of trying to like prepare her and soften the blow of like, well, you know, you're probably not going to win. And then lo and behold, she does.
But Valerie, like,
oh, sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
A little backstory. This is all in the book, Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted by Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong. Valerie Harper moved to Los Angeles and was in a stage production of Lil Abner, and she got hepatitis. And her doctor said, you need to eat bread and sugar to keep up your energy so you can recover from hepatitis. So she did. She gained like 20 pounds, and she got to be within the range of the weight that the Mary Tyler Moore Show creators thought of as Rhoda's body. They still didn't know if they wanted her or not, because James L. Brooks, and this is exactly what he said, she's still too hot for my idea of Rhoda. It blows my mind.
I think they cast her anyway. I think it's not until we get to Brenda on the Rhoda spinoff that we get to what Brooks had in mind for Rhoda.
All right. Brenda on Rhoda is like the greatest example of the spinoff math. When you make a character spinoff, you must take this peripheral character and centralize them by giving them a character that is them but more. Frasier had a Niles. Like, Niles made Frasier straighter and less fussy. Brenda,
Tony Randall to Frasier's Rock Hudson.
Yes. But I also think, like, with Rhoda, she's one of our first characters on network television who's openly Jewish. Mm. Before that, you had rooms full of Jews who were not allowed to break out all of their shit. And I feel like
There is a way the Goldbergs.
I mean, but that stuff is like, that dates from points in time when you still had like local sitcoms, right. When you know, what's her name? Betty White was starring
Elizabeth.
Yes, yes. like that's sort of a different era. And like, I feel like there's a way that that room just was like felt taken off of the leash with Rhoda. They could get like have fun. They could be mean, take digs. And the episode is just so lovely because I feel like it doesn't break the characters. It lets everybody, it takes these characters and lets them explore uncharted territory. One of the things I love most about Rhoda the Beautiful is, and look, it's full of stuff I think is a little bit gross. It's got very 70s ideas about like weight and that sort of thing and beauty. You've got all of that. But under its own terms, the way that Murray gets pulled into it is really fun. The way that they take Mary and give her a B plot that doesn't matter so that Rhoda can be the A plot, yep. But you still have Mary being Mary. But more than anything, the deployment of Phyllis in that episode is one of the most beautiful things ever, because you have this person who all she does is talk about how shitty and fat Rhoda is, having to deal with this and be her friend. And then for no good reason, Cloris Leachman sings 10 Cents a Dance halfway through. it's so fucking good. The way that, and I don't know what your guys' relationship to Birdcage is. I feel like, you know, gay guys who were adults when The Birdcage came out maybe have a more like critical view of it than I did, being a marginal adult at the time. But there's a way that The Birdcage lets absolutely everyone have their moments and be the best thing on screen for a moment. And Rhoda the Beautiful, but also so many Mary Tyler Moore episodes, really do let this ensemble sparkle. And like the like well-formed ego of Mary Tyler Moore to let the people around her shine the way that they did while always knowing it was her show is very impressive to me.
Thank you for asking what our relationship to the Birdcage is, because unfortunately it is quite often assumed that all of us thought it was wonderful from the moment it appeared on the cultural horizon. I was a fully grown person when The Birdcage was in theaters, and I had already been through ACT UP and Queer Nation, and I was not having it at all. I have since learned that it meant something to people at that moment, and has aged actually, I think, better than it presented when it first arrived.
We were because, steeped in the new queer cinema when that movie opened.
Yeah, like, we were angry about it. We were mad it wasn't Poison.
Yes.
Really what the thing was at the time.
It wasn't the living end.
We got over it. But so, yeah, it's this episode is so much keeping all the characters where they need to be and simultaneously turning it on its head.
Yeah.
And Treva Silverman, as you can read in this book, she was writing this episode kind of about her own experience when she won her Emmy for writing on the show. She wasn't at the Emmy Awards ceremony. She was at a weight loss spa. Yes. And yeah. So like, and it was reflective as well of the entire cast, because Mary Tyler Moore, just before the series went to air in 1970, she was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And so that, in conjunction with her own I'm a dancer kind of, you know, history, was like, I can't get fat. I'm skinny and that is my thing. Here are my legs. Everybody loved me. Meanwhile, the entire rest of the cast, save perhaps for Ted Knight, was constantly trying to lose weight.
Yeah.
Like Gavin McLeod,
Ed Asner,
Valerie Harper, Ed Asner, the
Cloris Leachman.
Valerie Harper decided that after getting hired to be the character, she decided that she was fat.
Mm-hmm.
And so she and only by TV standards is Valerie Harper a fat person. She has hips like a human being, you know. She lost some weight to be for this episode. And then the writers complained and said, "Oh, we don't have fun fat jokes for you anymore because you lost weight." So she gained some back so that they could do it. And it just blows my mind. Ed Asner at one point dropped from 250 to 210 because, in his own words, he didn't want to be a big round ball next to Mary Tyler Moore. And Cloris Leachman, who is saying something that an HR department would have you ousted for these days, she kept goading him to do it. And she told him that if he would lose 30 pounds, she would have sex with him. And he would get to like 28, 29 pounds and freak out. They would both freak out because he would think, "Oh, no, I don't want her to come to me to fulfill this offer." And she would be like, "Oh, please don't lose any more weight. We neither one of us actually want this." But, you know, actors are actors when they are saying loose things on the set. So that was the vibe backstage all the time. People are like, "Am I too fat? Do I need to lose weight?" And the only male character on the show, and we'll talk about this when we get to the little mini discussion of Mary Dates Lou, male actors weren't expected to think about that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway.
I will say my favorite Rhoda food line on this show is there's some episode where Mary's upset about something and Rhoda recommends chocolate. And Mary says, "Oh, chocolate never solved anything." And Rhoda says, no, "Cottage cheese never solved anything. Chocolate can do it all."
Oh, God. And if Valerie Harper could do anything, it's hit all the consonants in cottage cheese. The best possible way. But like having like that dynamic of resentment and love that existed between those characters of like Rhoda always hating Mary's privilege, but being in her corner. Like one of the things I love about Rhoda the Beautiful is that you get like Murray Rhoda energy. You get this sense of just sort of like we're friends. And you know, that this show ended in that iconic hug. Like, you know, it makes you understand how it built that kind of goodwill. And it was always a show that was full of cutting energy, that was full of critical energy. And I really do think Mary Tyler Moore's capacity to roll her eyes but be waspy enough to not say something to somebody being terrible was like exactly the right tone to have at the heart of this show. God, I get annoyed with them, my friends, but they are my friends.
Right. Her reaction shots only grow in their intensity and their frequency as the series continues, to the point where in seasons like 5, 6, and 7, all she has to do is like cock an eyebrow and you're noticing her do it. And the rest of the characters are saying something loud and she's being quiet, but she's reacting with as much intensity as they are with their words.
Earlier this year, at the very beginning of this year, I was working on a multicam that never happened. And I ended up watching all of Friends to just understand what these guys were talking about when it came to how Friends had changed multicams. But it's not until now that I realized just how much Jennifer Aniston's performance owes to Mary Tyler Moore of like, you know, and sometimes I should not criticize Jennifer Aniston for saying it was overclocked, but like the fact that like, I mean, Mary had so much Rob experience that she was, able to give like energy to the, like her shrugs God, like, you know, like this woman made of twigs shrugging that much should not look that natural, but it's so good.
There's a reason that it was in all seven seasons. The shot of her throwing that piece of meat into the grocery cart in the opening credits, to this day, I think is one of the greatest comic reaction shots I've ever seen. I can't even like parse it millisecond by millisecond to explain why it works, but it's pure gold.
Thank you for saying that, Alonzo, because Sacramento could not afford Mary Tyler Moore reruns. I did not get it until it came to Nick at Night. And when I saw that, I didn't even understand, or no, maybe I did see it when I was young. I didn't understand what she was doing. I just knew that it was iconic. And like that physical behavior, that fling was just iconic. And to this day, I fling meat into my grocery cart in that fashion.
I need you to meet us at our neighborhood Gelson's sometime. Because Alonzo Duralde and Guy Branum need to have a meat fling off in their grocery cart. Every time. Now, this, we haven't been to a grocery store in almost 2 years, but like every time we have been inside a grocery store and we're in the meat department and Alonzo Duralde has a moment and catches my eye, he dejectedly flings the meat into the cart. For my amusement. And this is why we have stayed together for 26 years.
But there is something I think about when you are the person whose name is in the show and you allow the big laughs to go to other people and sort of figure out a way to be funny while also being the calm center of a lunatic universe. That's a gift.
Yeah. Well, and it's almost interesting. You have to wonder if she wasn't educated to that to some extent by the previous show with someone's name in it that she was on, because like she, Rosemarie and Maury Amsterdam were big and Rob was Rob, you know? And I think it's like, we undersell the comic skills of women. Like, it, you know, we remake or we make sequels to dude comedy movies and we always recast the woman. And we frequently don't think about that skill set. But she was just bringing so much to the table with all of her delivery. Like, she did the hardest work. She did the hardest work and other people got to have more fun. Like, but the amount of mutual respect between them, like, to me, one of the things I love about the Mary Tyler Moore Show is just my idea that it is just the heart of professionalism about like writing and acting and directing on sitcoms.
When and I'm still blank. So Alonzo, take it away.
We'll come back. Just out of curiosity, Guy, have you ever seen any of He and She?
I have not seen any of He and She. That was Richard.
For Benjamin and Paul Apprentice.
Yes. I only know of Paul Apprentice from the Stepford Wives. Yeah.
They're great on this show. Like they play a newlywed couple and they're incredibly sexy together. But the show, it was in a lot of ways a precursor to Mary Tyler Moore, both specifically and generally because it was a very sort of like urban and urbane sitcom about people, you know, in their work lives and, you know, apartment living and that kind of thing, but specifically because the Ted Baxter character is basically a spin on a character that Jack Cassidy plays on He and She, this vain actor on like a superhero show that's based on the comic book that Richard Benjamin draws. And in fact, when Cassidy comes on Mary Tyler Moore to play Ted's vain older brother, that's almost like a tip of the hat, because they essentially, you know, I think Brooks and Burns went to the He and She people like, we want to do this character but with another actor, and they got the okay to do that.
Well, I wonder if you had shared writer DNA in some way. Like, it's always interesting to watch the way that writers strip the parts from the one season show that they were on And sort of like take something they thought was a good idea and reapply it.
Right.
I believe that the Torkelsons is the sitcom of the 1990s. Like there's all of this, like they had an Urkel before there was an Urkel. Like there's all of this shit that people were just like, well, that idea didn't get to have its life. Why don't I just use it on this other show I'm working on?
Alan Burns was a writer on He and She, and actually Treva Silverman has like a story by credit on one episode. Uh-huh. Yeah. But, you know, weirdly, you know, Brooks and Burns had both worked on My Mother, the Car, which is why that becomes a running gag throughout the course of this series. Like
that's so funny.
The awful stuff, like whatever WJM is showing, it always revolves around reruns of My Mother, the Car.
That's really funny. Like that is another thing about sort of like sitcom writer lineages that I think people don't understand enough. Like in my head, like the greatest heights that sitcom writing has ever achieved is the Frasier writer's room, and realizing how much that was also just the Wings writer's room is pretty ridiculous.
Exactly.
It all seems very incestuous. And frankly, I feel like every time I'm watching a show now, your name pops up in the credits somewhere. So I think there's always eight given people creating all of television at any given time.
I mean, it's really unfortunate that like, but there are ways that whether those eight people are broad thinking or narrow thinking, mm-hmm. I think defines an era of television. And I just feel like all of those people who proved themselves on the Mary Tyler Moore Show and then went off to other MTM productions or other shows, those people were sophisticates. Those people were people who wanted to make smart shows. And also the booming, just sort of, as you were saying, apartment living shows, like, you know, the world of the Bob Newhart Show or whatever got to be a more sophisticated place because people already had learned to fall in love with the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
True. Yeah. And also I think these were all the shows that followed in the wake of CBS canceling all the hick comedies.
Yeah.
You know, when they went through and had that whole purge of the Hooterville trilogy and Hee-Haw and all these other shows, which were still like big rating shows, but weren't selling washing machines the way they wanted to.
Well, I mean, that's, oh, really? Is that what the issue was?
Because basically, yeah, they wanted a more upscale and more urban, you know, a demo to be watching. So I think Jim Aubrey, who was running CBS at the time, just got rid of everything that had like, you know, a fence and a horse on it, and you know, tried to come up with and you know, Mary Tyler Moore. When that show launched, like it took a second to find its footing and they weren't sure. Like, I know there was a whole thing about like, they had to be very clear that she was single and not divorced because they didn't want people.
Yeah.
To think she was divorced from Rob Petrie, you know? and so it did eventually spawn a lot of imitators, but it's not like when it came on, it was this, you know, fait accompli of being like, you know, what TV is going to look like now.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I finally remembered what I was going to say. it popped back into my head. Recently, we were given a book, a kind of academic collection of essays called Wallowing in Sex.
Uh-huh.
And it's about television in the 1970s and how we started, you know, in 1970 with a character who is broken up from her boyfriend, living alone. But we don't talk about her being a sexual person. And as the series continues, we eventually hear bits and pieces, that whole
Don't forget to take your pill joke. Coming in early in the morning from a date the night before.
Yeah.
And how this only progressed. And Rhoda was the way it progressed, because in Road to the Beautiful, you finally get an acknowledgement from the show that this character is attractive to people,
mm-hmm.
you know, whereas, you know, for the first couple of seasons, she would go out on dates and she would describe them as losers, you know, guys that, you know, they don't get a second chance. But it's also very clear that Rhoda is having sex with these guys. And Phyllis comments on it. Mary doesn't really ever talk about it. But Rhoda is giving you all the information you need that, yes, I'm sexually active. Here are the goods. I don't like them, but I have needs. And
I'm on the pill, so why not?
And I'm on the pill, yeah. So she is in this beauty pageant. And finally, the show says, you know what? There's a reason she's having sex with these guys. She's actually really hot. And we've always known it. We're going to keep making fat jokes, but she is an attractive person. And from that moment on, after Rhoda becomes, you know, the permission for women in that show to have sex, eventually that's when we get to Sue Ann.
Yes.
And Sue Ann takes over because Valerie Harper is now gone. And Sue Ann is the, you know, voraciously sexual person on the show,
who introduced as, like, you know, as like a potential home wrecker for Phyllis.
Yeah.
You know, she's introduced in the Lars affair, where she is sleeping with Lars and Phyllis is freaking out about it. And it's only the threat of a, like, WJM morals clause that makes, Sue Ann sort of pull back.
Well, what's so interesting about it is always having Mary as center lets you shift center. And like, we always know we like and trust her. But one of the things, like, to the extent that Rhoda the Beautiful changes anything, it is just chipping at her perspective enough that, like, that Rhoda as a character is able to have a more nuanced view. Like, since we know these characters more, she doesn't have to be flat jokes about fatness and being unattractive. It can be more nuanced jokes about having bad self-esteem while having a lot to offer the world. And I think that's one of the reasons that it appealed to me, is that Valerie Harper as a character or as a person had not changed that much, mm-hmm. but that we were able to say, this person is beautiful. Like, this person, like, needs to change the way she's thinking about herself. And there was an episode of Growing Pains that basically completely cribbed Rhoda the Beautiful that I had seen before, and was maybe the first time that I, like, became, like, cried or became emotional identifying with someone in a sitcom when I was, like, you know, a tween or whatever. And I just thought that there was, yeah, there's something so nice about saying the sitcom can grow up while the world around it is growing up. And, you know, when you think about, like, how simple things were at the beginning of the show, and then how much more playful they could be with sex, sexuality, and relationships. Of course that had to happen. It was the fucking 70s. Right. But it's also cool to see a group of artists who were able to keep up.
What I also love about the development of Rhoda as a character is that it was Valerie Harper's costumes on the show, and not Mary Tyler Moore's, that began so many trends in the actual, you know, female population of the United States, that you aspired to be Mary, but you knew that you identified with Rhoda, and she had this very, you know, bohemian way of dressing that was incredibly current. I've read at least two different articles. I think one of them was even in Vogue, about how those outfits shaped, you know, women's fashion.
Yeah.
In the early 1970s.
And so
what you get is this wonderful balance of people. You get, like, you know, one character who is perfection, and another who is ostentatiously imperfect.
Yeah.
The imperfect person is the one that people take kind of to their heart and feel like, she's me. I can be like her, you know? So suddenly you've got women wrapping their heads in scarves.
Well, there's something so interesting about, I'm always fascinated by when Hollywood tries to pinpoint something that's a moving target. Like, the guy who's the hippie in The Producers is such a weird representation of a hippie. And, like, when I realized, oh, Rhoda, like, Rhoda is such an interesting reflection of what's going on in the world in 1970 without saying her character is she's a hippie. You know, it is just like a world where, you know, women wear scarves on their heads or have some fringe on some shit. And it's, I mean, part of the glory of Rhoda the Beautiful is getting to go to that fucking pink and purple apartment, that shitty apartment. And the fact that her clothes are always just like, they're just out. Like, she doesn't have a closet. But like them getting to just sort of, it like presages Carrie Bradshaw's walk through closet, the amount that they are getting to fuck around with the clothes there.
It's sort of like just like 3 days ago, Alonzo and I recorded an episode entirely about the 1968 Otto Preminger film Skidoo.
What is that? I'm not familiar.
Oh, guy.
It's an LSD comedy that stars Jackie Gleason and Carol Channing. That's what it is.
And your mentioning of moving targets is exactly what Skidoo is trying to do. And failing, but failing in such a bizarre way that it's watchable again and again and again. And the slow, the sort of lumbering quality of Skidoo was always gonna die, you know, as a more like quick responding medium, like a sitcom, would take those hippie characters that we see in Skidoo and translate them into a way that people can say, oh, this is just part of who we are now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What Maynard G. Krebs was for Beatniks.
Right. No, but this movie, it is available on DVD, you said, Alonzo?
And there's Skidoo? A Blu-ray of Skidoo, yes.
Oh, I, as Alonzo is fond of saying, I envy your first viewing of Carol Channing does a striptease while go-go dancing in a Rudy Gernreich zip-up outfit that you will take to your heart and cherish forever.
In order to try to seduce Frankie Avalon.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, this sounds like something I need to experience.
I think you do. So now, Dave, you mentioned that you also wanted to talk about Mary Dates Lou, which is, I think, the other episode that maybe threatens to dig into the seed corn. And it is very appropriately the next to last episode when I guess they've got nothing to lose.
To me, the longtime listeners to Linoleum Knife and LKTV will understand, and I've said this so many times that I've decided to stop talking about it now that he has recently passed. But Ed Asner was my first TV crush. I did not understand what that meant when I was 8, 9 years old. All I knew was that was a man that I liked. And as I got older, I realized that was a man that I liked. and it's the kind of man that you like when you are becoming a teenager and an adult that makes you think, well, am I actually queer? If that's the kind of guy I'm into, because everyone's telling me that that's not the kind of guy I'm supposed to be into. I'm supposed to be into this other kind of guy who leaves me utterly cold.
Casting and anybody that looks like that.
In 1983, when the world was going ape for Tom Cruise, I thought, oh, he's an interesting little plastic human being. I'm not interested in looking at him at all. I'll be over here watching Lou Grant. And so the thing about the Mary Dates Lou episode that I have been thinking about for years now is not the idea that they can't kiss, they can't be together, but it's the second to the last episode that ever aired, right? They were just going to throw anything against the wall in those last few episodes and see, just play with what they were doing with these characters.
Weirdly, the episode before it was a clip show episode.
Yeah.
The one where they sit in the dark waiting for Johnny Carson and show clips from her other bad parties, which is not a thing you do when you've got like two episodes left of a show.
Yeah.
But what you've had this entire time is a couple of things going on with the character of Lou Grant. One of them, he's the character who goes through a divorce. And he's the character who is known specifically to have had sex with two other characters on the show. Sue Ann, in a drunken one-night stand that we are to understand has happened probably again.
Yeah.
Against his better judgment, but it's still happening. And the sort of saloon singer girlfriend that makes several appearances after he divorces, after Edie leaves him.
Yeah. So technically three characters.
So we are, yeah, because it's played by two different women.
No, I meant he slept with his wife.
Well, that's never discussed.
They had children, Dave.
Okay, sure, they had kids. They had sex. Why? In any case, you are given a character who embodies what that earlier generation of men thought about themselves. They were a generation of men whose physical attractiveness was simply not a topic of discussion. Men ran things. They were not objects of lust. That wasn't their job. The show begins to hint at how women see Lou over the years. Georgette at one point refers to him as cute as a button. And Sue Ann openly lusting after him. But not routinely, not only did Lou Grant decline to be considered a sexually desirable person, other characters would refer to him, and this is going back to Rhoda, other characters would refer to him as fat, but not with the same sort of level of damning judgment that the word was used against Rhoda, for example, by Phyllis. But still, he was fat and therefore like out of the game, right? His wife divorces him, he gets the girlfriend, but we still aren't, in spite of the fact that the show is allowing him to be known to have sex with people, we aren't meant to think of him as sexual. He is just a beefy, chunky, middle-aged man. And when the episode Mary Dates Lou happens, you suddenly get a 1977 version of television in which, yeah, anybody can be having sex with anybody. and it's time for you two to look at each other as perhaps that kind of person. At this point, I don't think I had ever seen, you know, I was 13. I don't think I had seen a man be objectified on any level. On television, mm-hmm. openly by other characters. It wasn't until on WKRP in Cincinnati when Bailey looks at Gary Sandy and calls him Beefcake. That moment stuck in my head because I thought, is Beefcake what happens when a man is wearing very tight jeans and he has a really good looking butt? I guess that's what that means.
Weirdly, my first exposure to male objectification was Gary Sandy on a short-lived Norman Lear show called All That Glitters, where it was his sort of five-day-a-week Mary Hartman follow-up that tanked. But it was the idea that it was a world where women had all the power and men were, you know, subservient, whatever that means. And Gary Sandy played like the hot secretary that the women would all ogle whenever he left the room, and like the camera would hone in on his ass, and it was like, okay, that's allowed then.
So I think in the same way that Valerie Harper's body, Rhoda's body, is a topic of discussion for the entire time she's on the show, and to a lesser extent, I'd say on the show Rhoda, you get this understanding of Lou Grant and Ed Asner as a person for whom sex does not exist, because we're not talking about that with relationship to you. Until the very end of the series when, oh, yeah, no, it does exist. And you are as valuable as a sexual person as anyone else can be on the show. And the scene where Mary and Lou make eyes at each other in his office when they're trying to give each other their best seductive looks is... There are no words. They're not speaking, but they're giving each other the funniest, goofiest, unsexiest sort of come on glances that sort of like almost undoes everything that you're led to believe about her as a beautiful person and him as a, you know, a gruff, not beautiful person. But you still are maybe kind of horny for him anyway. I love that episode. I love that it ends with them realizing they have to stay friends. But I like also what it's doing in terms of pushing the sitcom idea of human sexuality forward into the world of, you know, Three's Company and Charlie's Angels and stuff like that, where everything was on the table. You know, the guys on Chips were hanging out with chicks in bikinis all the time, and the people on Three's Company were having sex with anyone they wanted to at any moment that they wanted to. Horniness was exploding just as Mary Tyler Moore was going off the air. And I'm just happy that they finally gave Lou the opportunity to have a moment of that, you know, because he was the sexiest man on television.
That's so interesting because, like, who Lou Grant was in 1970 is a person who we guess must have sex as a reflection of his office and status. He has children, he has Edie and all of that. And it's interestingly, the old Ginsberg quote that women's liberation is men's liberation, that there is this way that the female characters moving so much over the course of those 7 years, you come to a point where he is both has opportunities, but is also has the danger of, like, he leaves this place of security for liberty, you know? But there's also something so wonderful about a show that was truly pioneering in presenting. It was primarily about the core relationship was a male-female mentorship relationship.
Yeah.
And it's always, how will this be romanticized? And I think that there is something so cool about, with your last episode before the final episode, both exploring the thing and making clear, no, that doesn't work. Like, this is fundamentally not about that. And when I think about, like, what's good about Hacks is that it is a female mentorship show of a sort that I think we haven't seen before, where it's not as about intergenerational threat or whatever. It is about learning about each other. And then, of course, obviously, like, 30 Rock owes so much of a debt to the Mary Tyler Moore Show, that it didn't have to do. I mean, they occasionally nodded towards the idea of, Liz and Jack, like, why don't they think about this? Or sort of like, is this relationship occupying space that should otherwise be taken up by a romantic relationship? But I just think, like, it was so smart in a vacuum, the way that they handled that the whole way through, to show these two people learning from each other.
Fully.
It's almost that thing of, like, we can't end the series without at least exploring this, but we're going to explore it only to the extent that we explain that it's impossible.
Yes. Yeah.
It's like what Hitchcock says, that, people always say, oh, why don't they go to the police? So I wrote in the scene in Psycho where they go to the police so that you can see why no one goes to the police, because it's boring.
But it's also like the Mary Tyler Moore Show had earned so much credit by throwing so many characters in different directions that it really does have you. Are you guys familiar with the idea of schmuck bait?
Say that again, please.
Oh, okay. Schmuck bait is writer's room slang, and what it means is stakes that only a schmuck would believe. Like, it is like, I learned it when I was working on Awkward on MTV, and, like, we were talking, I think the showrunner brought up like a pregnancy scare, and one of the senior writers said, isn't that a little schmuck baity? And I had to learn about it from there. But, like, the thing is when you only have two episodes of something left, when you've done as extreme things as have happened on that show, when you had changed characters more than you had otherwise, like, the schmuck baitiness of Mary Dates Lou is removed, and it becomes a little bit more like what could happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's a thing where even though it's clear by the end of the episode that it won't and wouldn't.
Yeah.
Or rather it won't and isn't. It's not that it wouldn't, you know.
Yes.
That there has been so much a level of intimacy acquired over the course of seven seasons that it's like, well, I mean, it could, right?
Yeah.
Couldn't it? You know. But you also buy that it doesn't.
I think he keeps getting it on the side from Sue Ann after all this. Yeah. Because she's, I mean, if anyone is the 1970s on that show, it is Sue Ann. Because the horniness of that decade is something that, unless you were a conscious human being in that decade, you can't quite believe that it was real. You know, when people talk about that era, and if they were born like, oh, say 1975 or 1980, oh,
fuck you.
They'll be like, yeah, they'll be like, no, it can't be like you say it was. And I'm like, it was like that.
It's bonkers and doesn't make sense. And the number of variety shows cannot possibly have been true.
but plus the fact that, like, you know, this is a woman who on the air is selling this already antiquated notion of femininity. She is the happy homemaker.
Right. Yeah.
She is the cook and the sewer and the craftsperson and all the idealized housewife. But then in real life, off camera, she is like the most liberated of them all.
Another one of the really good things about the Mary Tyler Moore Show is Hollywood loves to make media about media. And there are ways that it gets too self-indulgent, and like, WJM was just enough. WJM was a paper pushing office 80% of the time. And then when you needed a Chuckles the Clown, like, and again, it's something that they fucked around with more as time went on. Like the Happy Homemaker, you saw a lot of where, like, you know, Ted in the Newsroom, it was simple and you didn't see a lot of it.
Yeah, it was, they were mainly pulling stuff off wires and Murray would type, you know.
Yeah.
And that is our discussion about the Mary Tyler Moore.
Guy, what would you like to plug? Where can people find you online?
You know, if people haven't watched Q-Force on Netflix, watch Q-Force on Netflix. It was a very sweet little show that didn't get the best of reviews. And there are a lot of good Princess Diary jokes in it. And they can find me online at Guy Branum across all social media.
Funny show, and also we were big fans of Connecting.
Oh, that's so sweet. It was like it was NBC's attempted a Zoom show, and it was really fun to do something people hadn't done before. I don't know that we figured out, but the guys who were in charge of it really let us swing for the fences, and I really appreciated that.
Like, I have no idea what a second season would have been, because you guys sort of lapped yourselves by the end of it, but I thought, yes, it was a great experiment in television to sort of deal with the things that are happening right this very second as we are living through them.
Yes. And also having the cast of a television show also having to produce the television show entirely in their own apartments led to a number of union issues that we didn't really get to play out entirely.
I am my own key grip. You are a delight, sir. Thank you for doing the show. We appreciate it. And
also, yes? I want to congratulate you, Guy. We're going to put a warning before the show, because people aren't used to profanity on the show.
Oh.
No, but it's fine. It's fine. It's fine. But I just want you to congratulate you. You swear more than Manola Dargis.
I'm so sorry. I didn't even realize I was swearing. I'm very sorry.
No apologies necessary. Every year, Manola comes on.
I've been keeping a list.
Every year.
I'm sorry.
No. We're not even going to bleep you, because it's just so effervescent.
It's too good. This is just going to go out with a mature on it, you know.
Every year, we have Manola on at the end of the year to talk about the best films of the year. And every year, she curses like a sailor. And every year, she swears and says, oh, I'm sorry, and then does it again. And The joke is that no one swears more than Manola Dargis. But you win.
We have a new winner.
You just beat her. Congratulations.
Thank you guys so much. I had a really lovely time.
Everybody, thank you all for listening. And hey, if you would like to hear more TV talk like this throughout the year, check us out at patreon.com/linoleumknife. We have lots of extra content, including this program, LKTV. And yeah, maybe you'll like it. I don't know.
Guy is not on every week, and we're sorry.
That's true. You'll just have to settle for us. But, you know, maybe it's worth a shot anyway. All right, everybody, take care of yourselves. We will catch you next time. Until then, goodbye.